This is episode number 43 with Tim Ferriss. Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin. Hey, all you beautiful greats out there. Thanks so much for tuning in today to the School of Greatness. And I'm super pumped for this episode, just like I am every episode, because we've got a very big, amazing guest on today. His name is Mr. Tim Ferriss. And yes, he's a three-time New York Times best-selling author, two of them which hit the number one seller on the New York Times best-selling list, and that's The 4-Hour Workweek, 4-Hour Body, and 4-Hour Chef. And he's now got a new project that I'm pretty excited about, and I know he is. It's called The Tim Ferriss Experiment, and it's a new TV show, which we're going to talk about today on this show with Tim. I want to dive into a lot of other things as well, and I am very excited because a couple episodes ago, I really got to dive in deep with the one and only Gary Vaynerchuk, and a lot of you have been saying that you've never heard Gary become so vulnerable and open and raw and honest in any interview you've ever seen or heard him speak on, and I feel like we got to capture that in this episode as well with Tim, and I was very gracious of his time and his vulnerability and his willingness to open up and just talk about a lot of different things that's happened to him in his life. And we really talk about what some of Tim's biggest fears are, the biggest impact on Tim Ferriss's upbringing with his parents and his family, Tim's own entrepreneurial failures. We talk about the simple, effective way to develop any business idea. We also talk about how to create rituals that lead to success. And something that I was really interested in was learning about Tim's self-talk and how he visualizes what he's going to create in the future. Now, I think this is an important step to anyone's success, is what they say to themselves internally and what they visualize before they actually create something. And I also talk about what Tim hopes people say at his funeral and what they say about his heart as a person. So I'm very excited to share this interview with you because it really opens up the world of Tim Ferriss and really who he is. And I'm very excited for you to tap into that. With that, guys, let's go ahead and dive into this episode with the one and only Tim Ferriss.
With Capella University's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Okay, quick math. The less your business depends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/greatness. netsuite.com/greatness. Again, head to netsuite.com/greatness. Drop the
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks so much for coming on the School of Greatness. Got a great guest on who's actually one of the first guests on the School of Greatness. So this is the first repeat guest, and his name is Mr. Tim Ferriss. What's up, Tim? Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me on again, man. It's always a pleasure.
Yes. And being that you are the first person to come on twice, hopefully we'll have you on many more times. But I'm very excited to talk about what the reason you're coming on is because you have a new TV show called The Tim Ferriss Experiment. And it's coming out actually tonight of the recording, but this recording will probably come out in a week. So it'll be out by the time this recording is out. And I'm very excited. I watched the first episode. It was amazing. I watched the trailer. It's a great production value. You add a lot of, you know, amazing components to it with your wisdom and your knowledge and how you're hacking everything. So I'm very excited about this series that you have coming out.
No, I appreciate it. The show has been, some folks may have seen a pilot that I did many years ago on History Channel.
Yep.
Which was called Trial by Fire, and I did Japanese horseback archery. And the challenge that I've always had with TV really is multifold. Number one, finding a team I can work with who will respect the sort of integrity of whatever I'm trying to teach and not try to create a lot of fake TV nonsense around it, right? Because I think the experiments that I do, whether it's Japanese horseback archery, or we can talk about some of the examples in the new show, like rally car racing and professional poker and drumming and language learning, all sorts of things. They're kind of exciting enough that you don't need to manufacture a lot of nonsense, sort of kicking it with the Kardashian style. So I'd like to avoid that. And it's very hard to do that because it's much easier in reality TV to just script the whole thing, which is the ironic part. And the second piece that's been really difficult is closely related to that, which is in TV, usually the host has next to no input on anything. So you have the producers, then you have the host. And so normally what will happen is, let's say someone like me will have a book, comes out, does well, they get approached by many different production companies who want to sign them to hold agreements. And those are basically usually very onerous agreements that restrict you from doing anything with any other production companies. Then they pitch you to the broadcasters and they own that relationship. And it's a really under-leveraged bad position to be in. So that happened the first time around. And I ended up not renewing my option because there was a point where effectively they said, look, with creative stuff, like you're the host, we're the producer, like get used to it. And I was like, I'm not interested in that. And it took a long time for me to take another look at TV with the proper leverage. And this show, you know, The Tim Ferriss Experiment is different in so much as, you know, I have two more books under my belt, a lot more experimentation under my belt, better contacts everywhere so I can actually get the best teachers in the world to participate, which is really cool. So you get to see how they deconstruct things. Like Josh Waitzkin, who's considered a chess prodigy. He was the basis for Searching for Bobby Fischer, who also happens to be the first black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu under a legend named Marcelo Garcia. So we did an episode on both chess and jiu-jitsu simultaneously, which is really, really cool. But the premise of the show is pretty much the same, right? I'm tackling a difficult skill each week. Like in the case of language learning, I have 3.5 days to learn a language well enough to be interviewed on live TV for 6 minutes in that language, which is Tagalog, and demonstrating to people that it's the way you're able to do that kind of thing is by deconstructing a complex skill and making it easy, making it simple, and then using a better toolkit. So you don't need better genetics. You don't need infinite budget or infinite time. You just need a better toolkit. And so the show delivers one or two of those tools from the world's fastest learners and best teachers each episode. And that's kind of the idea because, for instance, I mean, I couldn't swim until well after age 30, so we're doing an episode on swimming where we'll actually take one of my fans from kind of zero to hero in 4 to 5 days. And doing one on building a business, which is the same story, like straight out of the 4-hour work week, also with another mentor. And we're going to take someone from you know, hopefully zero to hero in 4 or 5 days to get their business up and running. So
you're not doing all of them yourself, then you're bringing in other guests and being kind of more the host of it.
I am, the entire show is a bit of an experiment, which is appropriate. So I would say I am the guinea pig for, there are 13 shows total. Every Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific is when it broadcasts. It's on HLN, which used to be CNN Headline News. Now it's HLN on the dial.
Okay.
And I am the guinea pig for probably 10 or 11 out of the 13. And then 2 or 3 of them are more, I would say, mentoring weeks for me, where I help someone else overcome their specific fears related to business or swimming or something else.
And what's the main vision behind the reason why you wanted to do this show specifically in the first place? Like what's the message you want to get across? Is it to reach a certain audience? Is it just to continue to spread what you're learning and let others be able to deconstruct things faster? What's the main reason?
Yeah, I'd say it's a teaching tool for me. And primarily, there are a couple of motivations for the show. The first is I think that many of the lessons in the 4-Hour Body or the 4-Hour Chef have really impacted people who have, let's say, never been able to follow a diet before. And now that they've lost 200 plus pounds on the slow carb diet. I mean, there are probably every week I hear from someone who's lost 100 plus pounds on the slow carb diet after never being able to lose weight before. And it's not because they changed necessarily. They didn't get a new set of genetics. They had a shift in mindset and a better blueprint for doing it. That's it, you know, and it was made simple. So I want to show people how to do that in any area of their lives, whatever they want to learn. They want to learn a musical instrument for the first time, learn a language for the first time, learn a sport for the first time, get over their shyness. There's a dating episode where I really look like a nervous wreck, which is hilarious. And I don't succeed at all these, by the way. Like, I do face plant in some of these episodes pretty hard. So that's motivation number one, is just to help people overcome some of their biggest fears and take big steps and, you know, try to wring more out of life. That's number one. Number two is, you know, I'm 36, not getting any younger, certainly. And I wanted to chronicle some of these crazy physical experiments before I have a family and settle down a little bit, because once I have kids, I'm not going to want to do the really dangerous stuff. Certainly not as much anyway. So I wanted to kind of chronicle a bunch of that stuff visually so I can, you know, show my kids and my grandkids how crazy dad used to be. and then last, you know, the show was a way for me to tackle some of my big fears and also simultaneously check stuff off my bucket list. So it just seemed like all around the right timing to give something like this a shot. And the other piece of the puzzle I would say is that I was able to handpick the production company I wanted to work with. And they're called ZPZ. They do all of Anthony Bourdain's stuff.
That's a great show.
Yeah. And I don't enjoy a ton of TV that's out there, especially in the non-scripted or reality TV space. There's just not much that I like, but they do really gritty cinematic work where the hosts can be themselves. They can curse if they need to. And that's my style. So yeah. That's been a fascinating experience as well.
Now, what is your biggest fear, Tim?
Biggest fear? Well, geez. I mean, I'd say my biggest fear is probably just watching my parents get older, quite frankly, but that's not one that makes for very exciting television. So probably won't make an episode out of that.
Right. But why is that your biggest fear though?
I think it's because it is the most painful for me to watch. And also, I mean, I think I suspect it will be. My parents are fine now, but the most painful for me to watch, and also one that is very much outside of my control. And there are things obviously that I'm looking into. I've spent time with a lot of scientists looking at life extension and ways of addressing different conditions and cardiovascular disease and blah, blah, blah. But I think it's something that everyone goes through, that nothing new there, but one that I have less control over than many others. And So maybe it's a fear. It's more of a pain than a fear. Maybe is the best way to look at it. But it's certainly not something I look forward to.
How influential have your parents been in your entire life? Because you went away for a number of years to study abroad. Is that correct?
I went. I did go abroad for a year to Japan, and then went abroad later during college to China to study at two universities there. The impact my parents has had is enormous, and I think in large measure because we didn't grow up with a lot of money, and we weren't dirt poor, but we were lower middle class, and didn't get the new bikes. But my parents did, I think, two things very well. Number one was they encouraged us to be really curious and try a lot of things and exposed us to many different things. So whether that was, say, a free aquarium or doing things outside that were very much like science experiments. I mean, going to the beach and gathering black sand with magnets and kind of learning about magnetism that way. That was number one. Number two was they didn't have budget for a lot of the kind of kid fun stuff like new bikes or BB guns or video game consoles or whatever. But they always told me and my brother that there was a budget for books. It's like, look, we if you really like a book, we'll find a way to make it happen. And whether that was the library or buying it for us, they taught us to associate a very high value with books. And I really think that had a big impact. And as a result, when I was in, say, third or fourth grade, I had this to my mind, expensive, like $40 hardcover book on marine biology, which had just, it was basically a visual guide to fish and sharks and piranha and all that stuff. And I would just sit out during recess and read this book because I was a scrawny runt. I was a born premature. I was really, really small until about sixth grade. So my best friends were these books that I came to treasure because my parents taught me to do that.
Mm. Did you have, so you didn't have a lot of friends when you were in elementary school, middle school?
I mean, I had a few other runt friends, but yeah, I wasn't completely by myself, but right. I was definitely not in the cool kid, the popular kid group at
sure.
all. Yeah.
So what was kind of your dream growing up? Did you always have these big dreams that you wanted to inspire the world or create amazing works of art, or just work in general that would influence a lot of people, or what was it all about?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I had any, huge ambitions. Even looking at my ambitions now, of course I always compare it to someone else. So I think that I'm just doing the best with what I have now. That positive impact, but like compared to Elon Musk or people like that, I don't feel like my ambitions are big enough yet. Right. But growing up, I wanted to be a marine biologist first, and that was that took me for a pretty good period of time. I'd say 5 years or so, 5 to 10 years, and then pretty quickly, around the same time, decided that I wanted to be a comic book penciler, so an actual comic book artist. And I took that very seriously and did that all throughout high school, even into college. Ended up as a paid illustrator. I did two things to pay some of my bills in college. I was a paid illustrator, so I actually illustrated graphics for books that Princeton University Press put out. And I was also and the graphics illustrator of a magazine there. And then secondly, I was a bouncer.
Wow.
put on a lot of meat between, say, sixth grade and freshman year of college. So I got a lot bigger.
Nice.
Once I figured out how to put on size, I was like, okay, I'm pretty sick of being a tiny kid, so let me get really stupidly large. And got up to about 190, between 190 and 200, which is pretty large for my frame at 5'8" to 5'9".
Right.
And bounce. Those are the two things I did. And the graphics, I really didn't stop doing that until the end of college, and sort of abandoned it to quote enter the real world, which was stupid, but I think a lot of people do that. They drop a lot of these passions of theirs to focus on whatever they perceive as being the real world, which to me was, you know, moving out west and joining a startup and buckling down and kind of putting my feet on the ground and learning how the real world works, which was not a bad thing. But, you know, I do fantasize about getting back to the illustration.
Mm. And when did you realize that the real world was a lie, or at least it was for you, and that you wanted to go back into living your passion? How long of the miserable jobs did you work until you started doing your own thing?
Yeah, I would say, you know, both there are a few different questions in one there, and I can answer them sort of chronologically. Scattershot. So the first is I played around with entrepreneurship in college, really, and even in high school. I read books like Losing My Virginity by Richard Branson, and was very inspired by these mavericks, and wanted to create some type of low maintenance stream of income. Of course, that's, you know, common dream, I think. And I was like, oh my God, it'd be so amazing if I just had, you know, X. And of course, X is this magical number that almost everyone has. You know, it started out, I was making $8 an hour working in this library at Princeton. And then I got the bouncing job, which was $20 an hour. And I was like, oh my God, I'm rich. And so that was a big step forward. And then eventually I was like, oh my God, you know, imagine if I could just make, what if I could make like $100 an hour, or if I could make, you know, $300 a week, or whatever the number was. And I taught an accelerated learning class actually at Princeton, which was really cobbled together. I mean, I used the daycare portion of a church because I couldn't afford to rent a location. So it was on a Sunday daycare center at like, you know, 3 p.m. or whatever. And if I remember correctly, it was a $50 seminar. It was 3 hours long. It was $50 to attend. Money back guarantee, the whole nine yards. If you're not happy, you can take the whole thing. I'll give you your money back. And I got 32 people, if I remember correctly. And I have never felt richer in my entire life. Because, you know, I walked out of that. I had been making $20 an hour with the risk of getting my head kicked in as a bouncer. And the graphics editor position wasn't paid, and the illustrator position was, but it's just, I really wasn't making much money at all. And I walked out of that seminar. It was a good seminar, but it was a little rough around the edges with, you know, $1,500 or $1,600.
And you're rich.
Oh my God. You have no, I mean, you probably do have an idea.
Yeah, I do.
You know, the first time you have like a moderately successful self-made venture like that. Yeah, I had all these checks and $20 bills and $10 bills and $5 it's like flowing out of my pockets, and had them bunched up in my hands. I was on a
drug dealer.
Oh yeah, bunched up in my hands against the handlebars because I didn't have, like, my pockets were so full. And I remember I biked directly to the bank. I was like, I have to deposit this stuff right now because who knows what's going to happen. And that was, I would say, my first real successful attempt. I had actually attempted to put together an audiobook before that in high school, where I was like, oh my God, this stuff is easy. And I read all these books that made it seem really, really, really easy. And it's not easy. It can be simple. But I created this audiobook for basically, I mean, in, I guess, current language, sort of hacking college admissions. And I produced this thing. I put like every penny I had into doing a first manufacturing run and didn't sell any. I tried to do it through classified ads. I mean, this was like the real infomercial shit, and did not sell anything. I was so depressed. And I didn't throw those audio tapes out until like 15 years later. I was like, one day these things are going to sell. And then I listened to them.
They were horrible.
Oh my God. I listened to them, and there's like my 14-year-old self, like shitty, like copyrighted, not shitty actually. It was poor recording quality, like classical music that I couldn't use anyway because it was copyrighted in the beginning. And it was so cheesy. Oh my God. Like, someday if I can find one of those audio cassettes, I'll put up some of it to be like, all right, here was my like version one. But skipping forward, you know, I dropped the entrepreneurship stuff with me as the founder and moved out west to the Bay Area during, you know, 99, 2000, during the dot-com bubble and boom to make my billions that way. And didn't last very long, of course. But I'd say after the first year or so of working with this startup, I became really jaded with how things were being done and decided that I wanted to start my own company and give that another shot. And that was when I started looking at basically my credit card statements and where I spent money. And it's a really simplistic approach that I still think is really valuable. It's still where I think you can find the lowest hanging fruit for business creation. So in my case, I looked at my income, which at that point was $40,000 a year. And then I looked at pre-tax and then looked at where I spent the stupidest amount of money, just percentage wise. You know what I mean? Like where am I somehow justifying spending an irresponsible amount of money? And it was with sports nutrition. And I mean, you're an athlete. You've seen this before. It's unbelievable how devout and consistent, especially guys, are with sports supplementation. And I was spending hundreds of dollars a month on sports nutrition stuff. And when I looked at my buddies who were, say, training in jiu-jitsu or whatever at the same time, they all did the same thing. And some of them made less than I did. And so I decided to lean back on some of my early days where I'd spent time in neuroscience and design a non-stimulant product, which was a pre-workout product. And that later became, you know, Body Quicken, which did exceptionally well, not out of the gate, of course, did exceptionally well. But I remember putting that together, and it took a good, I would say, if I'm guessing here, a good like 6 months to throw enough against the wall to figure out what worked. Because keep in mind, my only advertising experience really before that point was these shitty classified ads that didn't do anything. So I was starting from scratch to try to figure out what worked and what didn't. And there was this new thing out called Google AdWords, which I was one of the first users of. And
when was this? What year is this? Back in 2003?
This is like 2001.
Okay, wow.
2002. And man, it was a different world. I mean, things are so much easier now. Of course, things are more competitive now in other respects. Like Google AdWords is a lot more expensive than it was then. But that's kind of how it came together. And you know, since then, I've never gone back, I guess, in terms of I'm a crappy employee, man. It's just I get too impatient. I get too angry at inefficiencies. I'm not a great employee. I'm a good like lieutenant. If I have, for instance, that doesn't have anything to do with bucking authority. I don't mind authority, actually. For instance, in say a wrestling team, we had someone named John Buxton, Mr. Buxton, in high school, who was an incredibly good coach, incredibly strict, just took us to task and was very, very effective and efficient. I mean, he also raised the endowment for this high school, keep in mind. It's a private school that I transferred to from like 50 million to 500 million. The guy was a machine. And in his extra time, taught the wrestlers because he needed that to keep himself sane. And I don't have an issue with someone like that because he was a tri-varsity athlete in college, was a national caliber wrestler, and he's an excellent coach. So if someone's qualified and doing an excellent job, I'm happy to follow. I have no problem with that. But as it turns out, in the world of business, it's pretty hard to find those A players. You don't very often end up with a boss who's giving you more and more and more responsibility, pushing you to be better and better and better, and they are magnitudes of order better than you are.
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you get a new car or a new home, your first reaction might be to say things like, oh yeah, or I can't believe it, or booyah. But what you really want to say is the one thing that can get you the help you need. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm is there with the coverage you need for your car, your home, and even boats, motorcycles, RVs, and other things that matter to you. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is there to help you choose the coverage you need. With so many coverage options, it feels good knowing you can find what fits for you. And when you need ways to get help, State Farm gives you options there too, in person or on the phone with your local agent, or on statefarm.com, where their award-winning app State Farm lets you do things your way. So when you need help protecting the things that matter most, remember to say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. Like when you're trying to buy tickets for the best seat at your favorite team's big game, or when you're hiring for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. With ZipRecruiter, you can find qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I believe finding the right team member is one of the most important steps in setting up my company for success. We like to ensure our new hires will be a good fit before they're even on the team. So I am grateful that I have ZipRecruiter's help when we want to grow the team fast. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
You just don't, in my experience, run into that very often. But I mean, if someone like Elon Musk was like, hey, like, whatever, I want you to be my executive assistant for 6 months, like, I would probably take that job. You know what I mean?
Right.
I would probably take that job.
Unpaid.
But as it turns out, that phone call has not come. So I am in the meantime, doing my own thing.
Right, right. That's too much. Yeah, I mean, discipline is really a key ingredient for success, in my opinion. You know, I went to a private boarding school where it was very disciplined. You know, we had 2 hours of study hall every night and in bed by 9:30, and you had to make your room every day and you had to dress a certain way. And the practice was intense. School was intense. And that discipline really, I feel like, something I thrived off of. Again, like you said, when you have a good coach, someone you trust and you believe who's going to take you to the next level. So,
yeah. And I would say also just, this is maybe a side note, but since you brought it up, if you're an entrepreneur, and particularly if you're a solopreneur or operating on your own, I think you need to create structure and rituals so that you're only applying, you're not burning out you're not wasting your thinking horsepower on things that don't matter, right? Does that make sense? So for instance, yeah. when I went to from public school, which was a nightmare, not in all places, but on Long Island where I grew up, it was a terrible school, to boarding school, all of a sudden I had a lot more structure. And just like you said, we had chapel every morning, we had mandatory sports every afternoon, we had classes until I think 6:30 at night because we had one class block after sports. Then we had seated meal, coat and tie a few nights a week, had dress code during all classes. And that structure is really helpful. Some people think of it as confining. I think of it as very freeing.
So helpful, yeah.
Because you don't have to make decisions about all of the minute bullshit. It's all figured out. And I think that for entrepreneurs, it's very valuable for a week, for instance, to just figure out what is your ritual going to be in the morning or when you wake up? What is the first 60 minutes going to look like? and script it out and so that you do the same thing every day. And I think it's a very freeing experience where you end up feeling more energized. You have more energy and kind of thought power to allocate to the things that matter, as opposed to trying to decide, like, what should I have for breakfast today? No. Right. Like, eat the same thing for breakfast for a week straight. Just remove that so you don't have to think about it. Anyway, that's just a side note. I think ritual and routine is extremely important for people who want to be creative.
Yeah. I mean, I hear a lot of my entrepreneur friends who are struggling. They haven't created great habits and they're not disciplined and they're never consistent. And they're always going from one thing to the next and they don't complete things. Whereas, playing sports or going to school, or when I was playing pro football, even we had an itinerary every day. So all I do is look at the itinerary and show up, and then I give my best effort to the task at hand, and then, complete, rinse and repeat every single day. And I continue to get better and improve, and we are striving to achieve our goals. But if you don't have that routine or those habits, it's really challenging to get anything done that's quality that people are going to enjoy.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think that having a schedule of sorts is very helpful when you take into account things like Parkinson's law, which of course was in the 4-hour work week, might be familiar to some people, but meaning that a task will swell to fill the amount of time that you allot it, right? So if you don't have any defined end time, you'll check email all day long, no problem.
Right.
You know what I mean? And if you don't have a container, as I find sports very helpful for this, just as a bookend to close out the day, yeah, to do training at 6 p.m., where you are absolutely protecting that time as much as you would protect any other type of conference call or anything else. Particularly if you're, let's say, you're somehow accountable to someone else that you're going to do it with, like rock climbing, doesn't matter, then that blog post will get done in an hour and a half and not in 4 hours, you know?
Right.
And exactly. That type of bookend, I think, is very helpful.
Right. Now, transitioning to the next thing, what I want to know is, what is it you think about before something big in your life is about to happen? So, or big moment, a big opportunity, it could be a speech, it could be a board meeting or a presentation, before one of your episodes that you're about to film. What is it that you mentally or visually go through, your rituals, that allow you to prepare for the big moments in life?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, let me think.
Or do you just show up and take?
No, I don't. No, I definitely don't show. I don't just show up. I would say, if it is something that I can rehearse, then I will rehearse. And I remember the first time I had a keynote opportunity at South by Southwest, which was a huge opportunity for me. Yeah, this was probably 2007, something like that. And I had between 45 minutes and an hour to give a presentation. The first thing I did was I broke the presentation down. I mean, should sound familiar, right? This is just like Deacon's thing. So I took the presentation and I broke it into three parts. And that meant there were going to be kind of three acts to the keynote. And I would then I would have a very short introduction and a very short conclusion. So it was like 1 to 2 minute intro, act one, act two, act three, 1 to 2 minute outro, right? And what that allowed me to do was rehearse each act by itself. So I never rehearse a keynote all the way through start to finish to begin with. I will rehearse each of those acts or each of those segments until that segment is smooth. Then I'll move on to segment two and rehearse that until it's smooth, and segment three until that's smooth, and then I'll do them all together. In the case of South by Southwest, what I did, and I don't do this every time, but it will maybe be funny for people to hear, is I was staying with, all the hotels were sold out, so I was crashing at a friend's house in Austin, kind of out in the boondocks, and he had a big garage, and he had three chihuahuas of different sizes. So it was like a giant chihuahua, a tiny chihuahua, and a medium-sized chihuahua. This isn't a fairy tale. I'm going somewhere with this. So my friend had to go to work, and so I was kind of home alone until I had to head over to the conference center to do this keynote. And so I rehearsed by giving the keynote to these dogs. And if I check it out, if I was really animated and like compelling as a speaker, of course, I don't understand what I'm saying. But if I was really animated and compelling as a speaker, they would sit there and watch the whole thing. It was hilarious. If I got monotone or like looked down at my feet or didn't make eye contact, they'd just start wandering off. So I rehearsed it with these chihuahuas. But that's an example for keynote, right? So I have a format that I follow. I have a way that I rehearse. I have rituals, for instance. Like I don't usually drink diet soda for a lot of reasons. But in this case, before I do keynotes, I will drink 2 Diet Cokes. And I guess they're probably, I don't know, 12 to 16 ounces each. And that's the reason I do that is primarily ritual. It's not because I need that to be the only way I get the caffeine. It's because that's what I did for years when I had really good keynotes. And I just decided that that was going to be my ritual. So
you're like a baseballer player who like wears his socks on backwards or something.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Definitely. And I think we have rituals like that. I also slap the back of my neck before I go out on stage just to kind of wake myself up. So that's one. If I'm looking at, say, I kind of have to give you specific examples.
Sure, sure.
If we're talking about a big contract, for instance, like if we're talking about a big deal, whether that's like a book deal or a TV deal or you name it, usually what I try to do is limit the downsides. So I'll ask myself, like, what are the worst things that could happen? And then I will try to either eliminate that from my mind if it's not something I can affect. If it's a very serious potential downside that isn't addressed in the contract, I'll try to have clauses rewritten or clauses added. So for instance, in TV, what's the worst thing that could happen? The worst thing that could happen is I end up in a position where they're able to damage my reputation and integrity by putting content into the show that I don't believe is true or actionable or important, right? Or manufacturing a bunch of storylines that didn't exist. That kind of stuff is not okay with me. And therefore, I needed to find an attorney who could help, who had a track record of helping craft those types of deals for people who have a lot of leverage in one area, i.e. books, but very limited experience in the new area, TV. And I will always look to kind of protect the downside. And money is a piece of all these deals many, many times, but I don't often belabor that part of things. The reason being, if you have, say, a hit book or a hit TV show or whatever, you then have a lot of leverage to do things from that point forward, including, let's say, second book, royalties, et cetera, which is why, like, Neil Strauss, a friend of mine who wrote The Game and 7 other New York Times bestsellers, he doesn't care about his advance very much. He cares about the terms, but he doesn't care about the advance very much, because if the book is a huge success, he's going to get paid anyway, the same amount of money. And I have a slightly different tack, but I usually try to limit the downside. And I feel like if you can create enough safety nets and limit the downsides, the upside kind of takes care of itself, right? And then you can like swing for the fences if you know that you've limited the downsides. So those are a few of the things that I think about. I'd say another that I think about, and as I get older, I think about this more and more, which is, who am I going to be working with? Specifically, like on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, who are my points of contact? And do I like these people, right? Even if they're really good, like if they're extremely abrasive and throw sharp elbows all the time, like I'm just getting too old for that shit. I don't want to deal with it.
Right.
I don't want to deal with it anymore. And I'm very fortunate to be in a position where I don't spend a ton of money. I mean, I spend a lot of money on certain things I like, but I don't spend, compared to a lot of people I know, I don't spend a lot of money on creature comforts. I don't have a really expensive car. I don't have a really expensive apartment. I don't have a lot of these things. So I don't have to do deals with bad people to just keep my lifestyle afloat, if that makes sense. And that's very much by design. That's not accidental. And I think it's worth remembering also that it doesn't matter what a contract says. if it's done with a bad person. Like, you cannot do a good deal with a bad person. And anytime you think that's true, you're gonna get bitten in the ass. And it's like every single time, almost without exception, you're like, oh my God, this is a great deal. And it's the honeymoon phase, right? So like everybody's back slapping and high fiving, like, oh my God, this is a great deal. Everybody's gonna be happy. This is gonna be great. But in the back of your head, you're like, you know, that guy's kind of a dick or whatever. But whatever, it's a great deal. It's a great deal. And then you do the deal, and lo and behold, 6 months later, a year later, 2 years later, whatever it might be, that guy pops his head up and there's some big pain in the ass problem. Or they're like, yeah, you know, like, we really don't feel like blah, blah, blah was in the spirit of the agreement. So like, we actually don't want to pay, or, you know, something like that will pop up.
Right.
So yeah, you can't do a good deal with a bad person.
Now, the final part of this, you've given specifics, which I love, and I thank you for that. But what I really want to know now is, what do you tell yourself? What is the self-talk, the positive visualization self-talk? Do you see it happen before it happens when you're, again, shooting an episode, you know, because it might be a little nerve-wracking, about to be on camera, you want to do a good job, or if you're competing in jiu-jitsu or some type of tournament? What is the self-talk, the visualization, the things that you do in your mind to prepare?
I constantly visualize, and I think that that you do this as well, at least as an athlete you did. Well, there's the self-talk, then there's the visualization, and I tend to do those separately. Mm. When I visualize, I'm usually totally quiet. It's usually some type of rehearsal in my own mind. Mm. And I'll do that constantly for episodes, because I'll have an itinerary, and you know, we'll have a schedule that I helped lay out on some level based on, you know, the subjects I've picked, the teachers I've chosen, et cetera. And I will rehearse. I will definitely rehearse sort of intros, outros, sound bites that we need for specific portions of the show, which usually refer to introductions, right, of some type, whether it's introducing the show and the challenge, introducing the experiment, the location, the teacher. You know, these are things where I have to be factually accurate, and I also have to be concise. So I'll rehearse those. Fortunately, because it is intended to be a verite style unscripted show, for the most part, I get to just kind of be myself. But a lot of these shows are very, very physical. So I'm doing golf, I'm doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu, I'm doing rally racing, I'm doing you name it. And for those, I will constantly visualize, and I will also review video. This is closely related. I will review video of top performers in those sports right before going to bed. So I do video review right before going to bed, and then I will end up visualizing or dreaming oftentimes about those skills. That's a very consistent practice of mine. In terms of the self-talk, usually the self-talk, I'd say when I hit a tough point, is something along the lines of, you've done harder things before. That's usually, I would say, the self-talk. And honestly, like, I still think back to those wrestling practices in high school where Mr. Buxton would just crush us, and he would do it, and we thought we couldn't continue, and he'd say, I'm only pushing you because I know you can continue. And, you know, if you need to puke, there's a bucket in the corner, and then come right back in because you're up in like 30 seconds, you know? Right. And there's so many examples like that where I will, let's say, I'll be getting frustrated or angry or antsy in some way about something I'm doing now. And I'll just be like, you know what? This is a adult programming, right? Right. Yeah, I'll just say, you know, stop being a pussy. You've done harder things before. You're getting weak. Like, if this is hard for you, you are getting weak. So suck it up and like put on your big girl pants and get it done. Right. Done harder things before, and then I'm like, you know, all right, you're right. So I kind of have that hard ass coach like on my shoulder is most of my self talk, and sometimes I'll hear, you know, whether it's girlfriends or family members or some friends will say, you know, I should be easier on yourself. You should take it easy, be easy on yourself. And I don't think that's the answer. Right. When I meet people who I really admire, who are really good at fill in the blank, whether it's athletics or cinematography or whatever, they're all hard on themselves. It's not because they think they can be perfect, but it's not going to stop them from trying. I don't know. I don't think it's a bad thing as long as you know how to turn off some of the time. So I'd say most of my self-talk is, you've done harder things before. So like, suck it up, stop letting your mind run wild on you. Like if there's any negative self-talk, it's like, all right, nip that in the bud because it's not helping, and focus on what you can control, ignore what you can't control and get it done. So, it's usually some variation of that.
Nice. I love it. Okay. Two final questions. The first one is, what is it you want people to say at your funeral?
What do I want people to say at my funeral?
About you, obviously.
He never could get a tan. No, not that. I'm pretty pale, though. Let's see. I would want them to say, probably something along the lines of, he wanted his students to be better than he was. I always want to teach people to be better than I am in whatever I'm teaching. So I think that would be, that's the first thing that comes to mind.
I like it. What would you want them to say about your heart?
My heart? I'd say just that my heart was true. My intent, my heart was in the right place. I genuinely did all this stuff because I wanted to show people that things do not have to be as difficult as they seem. There are elegant solutions hiding out there. And if I can help unearth those, then that is a job I'm happy to have. So I'd say just that my heart was in the right place, that the motivations for this were on some level, I guess, altruistic.
Right. Nice. Final question. What is your definition of greatness?
Oh, my definition of greatness.
And Tim didn't get any of these questions beforehand, so he gets to think about it for a second.
I would say my definition of greatness is setting a goal that your former self would have thought impossible and trying to get just a little bit better every day. That's it. I really think that's it. And I think you can find that anywhere. The world's best janitor, the world's best, window washer, the world's best tennis player, the world's best, I have no idea, belt manufacturer, artisanal belt maker. It doesn't matter. I think you can find it everywhere, but usually it's setting, and that goal could be, I want to be the best janitor in the world. I mean, it sounds silly, but I don't think it is. I think that's a noble goal. So I'd say it's setting an ambitious goal that perhaps your former self would have thought impossible, and then just trying to get a little bit better every day.
I love it. Where is the best place we can hang out with you online? And tell us again the show times.
Yeah, definitely. So the best place to find me is on the blog. That's kind of the heartbeat of everything I do. It's 4hourblog.com, FourHourBlog.com. About 1.4 million readers a month. And then on Twitter, at T Ferriss, TFERRISS. You can learn all about the show at upwave.com/TFX. And the show is The Tim Ferriss Experiment every Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Set your DVRs. And on HLN, the channel is HLN. But people can learn all about it on Upwave. So at upwave.com/TFX. There are also extras and bonuses and stuff, cut footage and scenes on that page. So I hope people check it out.
I love it, man. Tim, thanks for coming on, and thanks for diving deeper than I think I've ever heard you talk about in any interview. So I appreciate you.
It's a product of the questions. So thanks for asking good questions.
My pleasure, man. Thanks so much. And everyone, make sure to tune in and watch each and every week. And we'll see you soon.
All right. Thanks so much, Lewis.
And there you have it, guys. Thanks again so much for being so tentative and listening during this entire interview. If you enjoyed this episode, I would love it if you head over to the site at lewishouse.com or schoolofgreatness.com to check out the show notes. Go ahead and share this episode with your friends over on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus and everyone else. And wherever you are listening to this in the world, go ahead and upload a picture on Instagram and tag me at Lewis Howes or hashtag School of Greatness. And just let me know where you're listening and maybe we'll give you a shout out for our future fan of the week. I really appreciate you guys coming on here and the feedback that I'm receiving about the people that we're bringing on, the guests, what they're opening up about in their lives and their success and their failures. I appreciate the feedback that I'm receiving about that. And I'm going to continue to bring on guests and get them to open up in ways that you've probably never heard them open up before. It's all about reaching your biggest potential and unlocking your inner greatness here on the School of Greatness. So with that, guys, you know what time it is. It's time to go out there and make sure to do something great.
At Metro, get an iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system for $99.99. Take amazing pictures and share them instantly. And don't put up with life's yada yada.
Yada yada.
Like photo bombers. Zoom, crop out,
yada yada,
and bye.
You don't take yada yada in life, don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Get iPhone 12 with 5G with no activation fees and nada yada yada. Only at Metro by T-Mobile. Switch to Metro, bring your ID. This offer isn't available for customers currently at T-Mobile or that have been with Metro in the past 180 days.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I've learned the hard way that constantly holding on to your emotions and repeatedly choosing to not talk about your feelings will only make you feel worse and worse. And up until about 10 or 11 years ago, I was afraid to talk about my trauma that I experienced. And I know we all carry around different stressors, big and small. And when we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. But therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to fit your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Lewis today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/L-E-W-I-S.